I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello and welcome to This Is Your Laugh, the podcast that interviews well-known female stand-ups and comedy actors about what comedy has taught them about life. This podcast is brought to you by ITV Comedy 50/50, and we're your hosts, Roxy and Alice. BAFTA Breakthrough Brit Susan McComa has already established a diverse and award-winning body of work in her relatively short career. A member of the National Youth Theatre as a teenager, she defied her parents' hopes of becoming a doctor and instead gained a place at RADA, where since graduating she's continued to establish herself as one to watch, with eclectic roles across stage, film and television. Her screen credits are far too long to list, but you'll certainly have come across her talent. Perhaps as the eccentric Cynthia in BAFTA award-winning Chewing Gum, or as the lonely outsider Raquel in the E4 Netflix show Crazy Head. Susan is currently starring in Channel 4's brand new comedy series Year of the Rabbit, opposite Freddie Fox and Matt Berry, and can concurrently be seen playing the role of Sabrina in the new BBC series Dark Money.
If appearing simultaneously on our screens wasn't enough, she's currently delighting audiences on stage in the Regent's Park open-air theatre production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, portraying the iconic role of Bottom. Aside from her innumerable acting accomplishments, she's also established herself as a notable talent in screenwriting, with her own screenplay already under her belt for BBC Films, commissions at Tiger Aspect and Objective Media, and a co-writing credit on an episode of Ramesh Ranganathan's Sky comedy The Reluctant Landlord. And if you haven't seen her in all of that, podcast fanatics may have heard her co-hosting the phenomenally successful podcast, The Guilty Feminist. Susan McComa, welcome to the show.
Yeah. Hey, she's in the house.
God, I want to know her. She sounds great.
Oh my goodness.
She
just... want to know her.
She sounds like she doesn't sleep.
Do you sleep?
No, not at all.
Let's go back to the very beginning then. Cool. The dawn of time.
You're not that old. Pretty much. No. I feel that old. Like a dinosaur. Yeah, go
for it.
There
was a big bang. And as we mentioned in the bio, your parents hoped you might become a doctor. Mm. Was there ever any chance of that actually coming to fruition? Can you imagine yourself with a stethoscope?
Do you know what? I could, but this is where the lines of acting and actual, like, medical school got blurred, because I used to love watching ER even though I didn't know what was going on, and I kind of feel like their ambitions for me came from me watching ER so diligently, and they were like, oh gosh, she's really into this is great. But I didn't really understand acting, and that was what I was interested in. Like, for instance, we used to watch, and my mum's obsessed with Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, we used to watch all his films way too young, like Commando, that's it. Commando, Last Action Hero, like all these films that we shouldn't be watching as children. And I used to think that the actors, like whenever they'd get shot and die, I used to think that the actors would sign a contract saying that they would die. So when I'd see actors reappearing in films, I was genuinely scared, because I was like, but they're back from the dead. Or like when he gets shot and then I'd see him in something else, I was like, but he's well, he doesn't have the limp. It was very, very confusing. So basically, I catfished my parents, because I was like, oh, I'm going to be a doctor. And they were like, great. But what I meant is I wanted to be Alex Kingston in ER.
A doctor on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is amazing. So you still wanted to act, even though you thought that you would have to die as a result
of
it.
Yeah,
that is serious. I'm not messing around.
Did you ever watch The Crystal Maze? The Crystal Maze, is that what it's called? You know, where they get locked in the room? Because I was like, they're gone. They're a goner.
Crystal
forever.
Maze.
So you know where the guy, he leads them round?
Yeah. I used to love that. Yeah. No, I sort of understood. I understood that because that was like a game show. But genuinely, with movies, I didn't know where the lines were.
Wow.
So it took me ages. I mean, I was very young by this, but I wasn't like 16. I was a child, like little. So I didn't really get it. So I think that's when my parents got the doctor thing. And then I slowly, when I sort of realised what acting was and that was what I wanted to do, it did feel like I was breaking it to my, it did feel like coming out to my parents.
Yeah.
And going, do you know all that stuff that I was saying about, I couldn't give a monkeys about any of that.
What was it? Was it the sort of the drama of, because ER is very emotionally sort of fraught, isn't it?
Very fast-paced and all of that. And there's George Clooney and all that. And I think that's what it was. And so when I sort of said to my parents, actually, I don't want to do that, they genuinely were a bit confused and betrayed. it was kind of weird.
So what age did that happen at then?
Well, in terms of me actually vocalising that I wanted to be an actor, I hinted at it when I was choosing drama GCSE, and my dad was like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "I just, I'm just a little bit interested. Just, whatever.
Just going to dabble.
That's
fine,
whatever." It wasn't until I got into RADA.
Oh my God.
That I was like, "Yeah, I'm serious about this now."
Is it because you needed the validation of a school that is that prestigious to say, yes, she's actually really great and we want her?
Yeah, I think it was a mix of things. Because me falling in love with acting and then realising that I could do it myself, there was a bit of a gap. So I would, like you said, I was with National Youth Theatre and I loved it and it felt like summer school and I just met all these people who are now actors but didn't know it at the time that was what I wanted to do. And then it wasn't until I was, what we all have to do when we're picking our GCSEs and facing our future and doing A-levels, I went, actually, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? And then that's when I found out that drama school existed. That's also when I found out that, I would be in as much debt going to drama school if I went to, Cambridge because of student loans and whatever. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be in debt, it might as well be for the thing that I want to do as opposed to studying English and coming out the other side of it going, do you know what I mean? So that was what the decision was, basically going, oh, if there is a school to go, because I'm a bit studious. I was like, if there is a school to go learn the actings, then I should go to the acting school. So that was it was at that point. And I thought, I'm not going to worry my parents with the auditioning and, do you get in recalls and whatever. We'll just see what happens. And then I got into RADA and I was like, should probably tell them now.
Oh, wow.
And my mum, I remember telling my mum very secretly, going, Mum, I've just applied for this place. She doesn't know what RADA is. But the first thing she said was, don't tell your dad.
Really?
So I was like, cool, not going
to
tell him.
It's going to be a hard one to keep a secret, isn't it?
Well.
Oh, God.
I then was doing, because they had a hard time, like me doing National Youth Theatre. They were a bit like, you should be doing something else to do with medicine or whatever and not going off and doing this stuff. And I was like, it's just a hobby. Lies. Yeah. And I was doing a show in Salford at the Lowry. And this was the summer before I started RADA. And I got a letter. You get these letters going, welcome to RADA. You have to get a leotard. Like, you must buy these books.
Oh, yeah, the long skirts.
Rehearsal skirts, jazz shoes.
For £500.
For £500 of your money. I'm like, wow, maybe I should have just gone to Oxford because this is expensive. Anyway, so got one of those letters and my dad had a really annoying habit of opening my post. So he opened my post and I got a phone call from him and he was like, so you're going to this place called RADA? And I was like, yes. And he was like, we'll discuss it when you get home. And I thought, so I got home and very quietly, very calmly was like, all right, so you're definitely going to this place. I was like, yeah, I am, I want to, it's what I want to do. And he was like, cool, you have to leave. So he kicked me out.
No,
kicked
really?
Me out. I know the sad bit now. He kicked me out.
It is.
And so, I was completely fine. I had a teacher who lived in Highgate, my friend Maria Leaf. Shout out to Maria.
Shout out Maria.
She is the one that really encouraged me and sort of went over what is drama school and what is this and what is that and everything. And then she was like, I've got a spare room. And I knew her son and, I was sort of took me into her family. But the thing, it seems very extreme, and it is actually, looking back, very extreme, and I know that my dad, before he passed away, felt bad about it. But it was to do with his fear. He didn't know anything about this world. Yeah. He couldn't protect me. And also, my parents were immigrants, and they come to this country hoping for a better future. Then I turn around going, I want to be a penniless actor. It must be utterly infuriating. It's like, you could be anything. You could be an estate agent and you're choosing to do this. So he just got angry and felt a little bit betrayed. But it took him a little while before he came round.
And he did come round, did he, as he saw your growing success? Because, I mean, you are far from a penniless actor, but obviously
far
that must
from.
Have been
I
far
am
from.
So flush.
She's rolling
so
in it now.
Rich. Oh, my God.
But as he saw your success, did you start to reconcile?
A little bit. He sadly passed away about 2 years after I left drama school. But all they wanted to see was that I was going to be all right. And I'm very self-sufficient. And that's thanks to him. He didn't realise that he spawned somebody equally as stubborn. definitely by towards the end, he knew that I was going to be okay and would sort of be like, oh, I saw you on Holby. And why didn't you tell me that you were going to be on Holby?
Because all like, the doctor ones again. Like Porters, yeah, he would have loved that.
He would have loved Porters. He's like, oh, you're a porter starting as a porter. Aspirations to be a doctor. I love this character. Yeah, so he just wanted to make sure that I was all right. And by the end, he knew that I'd be.
Yeah.
It'd be fine. Yeah.
That's so, wow. I think that's so incredibly brave that you still went ahead and carved your own path despite all those things.
Oh, yeah, because I don't know. I don't know what pigheadedness, I don't know what it was. I just kind of, because there wasn't anyone really that looked like me on TV, so it wasn't that. I came across some really amazing people like Maria who told me that I was good and I believed it.
Yeah.
Or like would encourage me and, you know, encourage my voice and say that I had something to say. Also, I loved comedy. That was always this thing that I would go to. That was my go-to to go and watch. So I wanted to be a part of that world more than feeling discouraged from it. I actually don't know. I think it's to do with the mentors I met along the way.
So do you think that is what motivated you then? Was the people saying, you know, giving you the approval of saying, we think you're good, we think you should go for this?
Yes, 100%. But then that leaves you at a really funny crossroads when you're at drama school and your mentors are not there and it's just you. You have to then become your own cheerleader. And that's where it was really hard, because then you get the voice all going, why did you think you could do this?
Yeah.
Why are you at RADA? Why don't you just go to juggling school? Like, why on earth are you here battling with Chekhov? So, yeah, that was the next bit that I had to kind of overcome.
Do you still find yourself having to be your own cheerleader? Have you reached a point now where you feel, you know, confident on a daily basis?
Yeah, you do have to be your own cheerleader. And also because I've never seen my career or anyone's career as levels, as like going up a level, anything like that. But your career does change, particularly for women. I feel like what they don't tell you is that your casting bracket, so the bracket of, you know, characters that you can play, changes so quickly at a faster rate than you. So the characters that you play when you're 21 is completely different to the characters that you play at 24. Whereas with men, you do not get that. You are playing the love interest until you die.
Yeah.
But it changes so far. And I saw it with a lot of my friends who sort of left drama school and started playing ingenues, and then literally by 24, you're too old.
Yeah. You've got a 9-year-old child.
Where's your baby?
Yeah.
Where's your baby? Totally. Put a baby in a hand now. So you're constantly battling like what the world sees you as in like the wider world, what industry, television, film sees you as, how you see yourself in the world. There's a dear friend of mine called Susan Brown, who's a fantastic actress, who's quite a bit older than me. And, you know, she's so fun, she's so sexy. And we had a really interesting chat where she was just like, I'm constantly being cast as like grandmothers who don't feel anything. And that's just not me. And then she ended up taking a part in Angels in America at the National, which went to Broadway, and then she got nominated for a Tony.
Oh,
and it's just like, you know, when people sort of give you the opportunity to do more, you can, but you get limited so quickly as a woman. And so you have to really be on top of how you see yourself and what you feel like you can play, because you're constantly being told by the world, whether it's society and nothing to do with acting, and then the industry, what you should be. So cultivating your voice of like your inner cheerleader is really, really important. But it's more than just cheering yourself on. It's like really getting to grips with, you know, am I changing, or is the world just telling me that I'm meant to change now? Or it's hard,
because you have your own personal growth and progression outside of your career, and then you have the one within your career, and trying to figure out where you should be on your own track as your own person must be quite, the lines must blur sometimes, that perception of yourself.
And there are certain things that happen that reinforce your personal life in terms of work and whatever. If this is up for debate, audience, but like, I never really had any sort of husk to my voice. And then actually when my dad passed away, my voice I lost my voice for like a month.
Oh, really?
It completely went. Didn't really know what it was about. Panicked a bit. And then I did a play, and I was working with this amazing voice tutor called Barbara Hausman. And she was just sat me down and went, tell me about your voice. Just tell me about your voice. And I was like, well, my voice sort of, it went for about a month and it came back. And since it's come back, it's got this little bit of a husk to it. And, you know, I saw this specialist and da-da-da. She went, okay, interesting. Has anything happened in your life recently? I was like, yeah, my dad passed away. She went, it will be that. Your voice is broken.
Oh,
and this
wow.
is your voice. And it was something, you know, we do so much work on the voice at drama school. They don't tell you that life stuff will affect your voice.
Yeah.
My voice broke. And this is now my voice. And now I do so much voiceover. So it's
oh, my goodness. So how different is your voice now what was before?
Well, I was quite high.
Really?
Quite
high voice. Oh, I'm intrigued.
I didn't have that kind of husky. I think it's husky. To it at all. And I could sing higher as well. I can still sort of sing high. But all this stuff that I just thought, oh, gosh, like, you know, I'm not doing all the right things to preserve my voice. And she just went, your voice is, this is your new voice.
Wow.
Make
it's
friends
so
with
fascinating.
It. It's so fascinating. Yeah.
I love the psychology of things. I get a little bit woo-woo and into
all
of this.
Yeah, no, I do as
like,
well. I love it.
Yeah, I love it because, you know, you talk about a broken heart and you talk about changing and developing your personality over the years. But the idea of your voice actually breaking as being part of that, I don't know if you'd call it personal growth or what. Or
expansion, life, all of that effect. And you sort of go, well, of course it does. And this is stuff that you're not really... Particularly as women, it's like you know, this is your voice and this is what it's going to be like. It's like, no, women historically get battered by life. Yeah. You damn right it's going to affect you in some way.
Yeah. You just hear it when women get older, their voices just drop and drop and drop. I mean, it doesn't bode well for me.
I'll be literally on a bass note,
a single bass note.
You'll be very well.
But yeah, and so that must be just sort of the weathering of life.
But also, it's just, I love my new voice. I think it's really cool.
It's a great voice.
So thank you. So it's just things like that where, you know, you're changing the way the world sees you, the way the industry sees you is mad. And me, I'm now 31, I'm in this really weird, like in Dark Money, I'm playing this mother. I mean, I had no qualms. Like, there's also this big thing amongst people in the industry. It's like, when did you start playing mothers? You must put it off for as long as possible. Because once you play one mother, that's it. You'll be a mum.
Oh,
and so I remember thinking, that is bollocks. So I want to play a mum, like, quick. But yeah, I remember the young actor playing Toot. I remember meeting him going, huh. He's called Toot. He plays Tyrone.
Yeah.
And I remember meeting him going, well, he's taller than me. He looks quite big. How old is he? When did I have him?
Yeah.
And Lewis, our director,
is this biologically possible?
Yeah, Lewis, the director, was like, I'll just add a couple of years on you and then it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Because I'm doing the maths and they're like, yeah. Don't worry, it's fine. You could play a range. You could play a range. I was like, okay, all right, age me up then.
I think that's amazing. Great. I mean, so going back to this idea of you saying that you have to sort of resist the image that the industry makes for you, is that a practical way that you do it then? So you say, yes, I will take the mum role, but then also, and we do want to talk about Bottom. And
yes, of course, yeah.
So is that the way you do it? You say, I want to play that, but then at the same time, I'm going to play this.
And... Yeah, I mean, that wasn't strategic in that sense. With Bottom, it's a, you know, Shakespeare gets put on all the time. So if there is a Shakespeare play that's being put on, I go, right, what are we doing that's different? What are we saying that's different? Because if it's the same as it's always been done, I'm really not interested. So for me, the attraction was playing Bottom, playing that role. But I remember in rehearsals sort of, and not even rehearsals, I met up with Dominic Hill, our director, and Vicky Richardson, our casting director, just before, once I got the offer. And I remember sitting there going, so what do you want to do with it? Like, what? I know that I'd be playing Bottom, but like, what are we saying that's new with it?
Yeah.
And Dominic was like, you know, with Bottom, she is this really annoying, like, amdram actor who sort of bosses all her fellow actors around. But they love her and they find her really endearing. But with a lot of productions that you go and see, you normally see Bottom being played in a way that sort of dominates everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of go, we wonder why all the mechanicals like him. And so he was, it's not about sort of making her softer or anything like that. It's just her need for amateur dramatics. Yeah. And I was like, I get that.
Yeah.
She's that guy.
Yeah.
She's that dude in a hall in the country just going, I want to play everything and make the set. Like, that's who she is. So So yeah, so that was what the attraction was. It's complete coincidence that Dark Money has come out at the same time as me doing Bottom, at the same time as Year of the Rabbit, which couldn't be more different. But that's always what I personally have wanted in my career, was to do as much in terms of range. And I've had that in theatre, but in TV, comedy has been the thing that's opened up to me. So when Lewis Arnold, the director for Dark Money, who I've... He's actually the only TV drama director who I think believes I can do drama and has done for years. Like, he's got me in for so much stuff. There was a project I was meant to do and I couldn't do, but he's been like the dude who's like, him and Victor Jenkins, the casting director, are like the two of like, of course you can do this.
Yeah.
Of course you can do this. And so
the you trained at RADA.
I mean, went to RADA, you can do it. Yeah. Guys,
come on,
RADA Academy. Anyway, so it's great that my first drama is with him, but it's total coincidence that it's all come out at the same time and couldn't be more different.
Yeah, so how do you approach a role like that? Because obviously it's so iconic. You've had Matt Lucas play it, David Walliams, Richard Griffiths.
Did Dawn French play it as well?
She's so amazing.
Did you see her Bottom or not? No, that might be helpful, do you think?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen A Midsummer Night's Dream, and actually quite a few of us in the cast haven't, but I think that was really, really good.
It's quite impressive to have avoided seeing Midsummer Night's Dream. I mean,
you've never seen it.
When I dodge a Shakespeare, I dodge a Shakespeare. Do you know what I mean? Haven't managed to dodge Hamlet. I've seen that one.
Really?
How many times? Mm. Oh, God. Yeah, no, weirdly, which has been great for this. But yeah, like approaching it, I was worried to be, and Dominic, our director, will attest to this. I was really worried pretty much the entire time. Pretty much right up until press night, I was. And probably still now. I'm a little bit... Because all you've got to do is trust in the whole production. And what Dominic wanted to do was sort of push the darker elements to it. Because there are some horrible bits. There's a bit where Lysander tries to throttle, literally choke Hermia to death on stage. And normally everyone glosses over and goes, ha, ha, ha. And he didn't want to overlook any of those undertones. So that means getting the comedy, which Bottom definitely is... that's the function of Bottom and the mechanicals, the other actors in the troupe. That's their function. So it was, just trying to strike the balance of that and not lose your nerve and really be a part of the company and not worry too much about what am I doing different.
Because Titania has sex with Bottom, doesn't she?
Well, hey, do you want to know something?
Yes, I do.
Titania doesn't have sex with Bottom. This is some freaky deaky thing that we have written in Shakespeare. Doesn't happen. And Titania is played by an amazing actress called Amber James, who's 24.
Oh my god.
Yeah, thank you very much. And she is she's got Judi Dench vibes about her. Wow. And how can you be? Anyway, it's irritating, but also delicious. She's so fun to play with. So we were talking about, obviously I become a donkey and she falls in love with me and da-da-da and all of that. And he said, do you know what? If you read the play, they don't have sex. And we were like, going through all the pages, going, oh my God, that's so true. So what is this? He's like, that's just humans for you. And so what the whole point of Titania falling in love with a donkey is, it's a punishment. She doesn't love Oberon. Oberon gets jealous and possessive. And so he goes, right, the next thing that you see is the thing that you're going to fall in love with. Then I turn up. She's like, oh, I love a donkey. And so what we've decided to go for is the unrequited love of that. So she loves this donkey. And the way that I've decided to approach Bottom is that Bottom is like, oh, the fairies are much more interesting. The fairies, the magical forest, all of that is cool. This person going, oh, I love you, there's bigger stuff going on. And so we play on that, and that's really cool. But yeah, no sex. That is a manufactured thing.
And the pain of unrequited love.
Now
sounds
that's
like a comedy.
Real.
There we go. So obviously you have done a lot of comedy. You've talked about Dark Money being your first venture into drama.
Yes.
Yeah. Preferences, or sort of is it the dramedy that you sort of inclined to prefer?
Ooh. Well, in terms of my writing, it's dramedy. Just because I feel like you can get whatever you want to say across with a lot more power if you try and make someone laugh but also try and make them cry.
It's a lovely combo, isn't it?
It's a lovely combo. Or Fleabag is just the best example of that, I think. Yeah. I mean, I love series one, but series two
knocked it out
of
the park.
My goodness. Yeah. And that is absolutely my taste. I love stuff like that. So in terms of what I'm writing, it's definitely that. In terms of acting, going into comedy wasn't anything that I set out. It's what I love, like my personal taste, but it's just the doors that opened up to me, and so you go through those doors. And I found, you know, like one of the first comedies I did was Bluestone 4-2, which is BBC Three, and I felt like all the team on that were just so open and encouraging, and you know, one thing leads to another in that respect. But doing Dark Money was it just reminded me that I could do drama, because if you don't do it, how do you know that you can? And so it was just good to go, oh no, I can do that. And also it was such a great team, because of the subject matter, we had to make sure that the set was a happy set for Max.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
Well, I was dipping in and out for months, but, you know, Jill and Babu were the guys, and Olive Gray were the guys who had to sort of have the big chunk of it. But every time I was on set, maybe it's just because I emit sunshine, I don't know.
Of course.
But no, it was a really jovial set. The boys were allowed to play and mess about a bit. And yeah, I think that was definitely manufactured so that these boys could feel safe.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I sort of arrived thinking it's going to be like Line of Duty, isn't it? You know, all those actors Line of Duty, they're all like doing serious work. It's all serious work. And they arrived, I was like, oh no, it's, oh okay,
I don't need to lie in semi-supine just,
you know,
before
I
do this
breathing. I'm sure
I read somewhere that with a drama set, maybe it's a particularly harrowing production, that everyone was so jovial off camera because they just had to, in order to balance it out a bit.
You absolutely have to. Like, I can't imagine. I mean, that was what I stereotypically thought of a drama set in my head, and I turned up and I was like, oh god, it's not that at all. But yeah, for that shoot, like, they had to have that there, because it was, yeah, it's really, really harrowing, and sort of looking into the eye of every person, parent's nightmare, really. Yeah. So yeah, in terms of the experiences, they weren't that different.
No, it's really interesting.
Yeah. Obviously, on the Guilty Feminist podcast, you co-present and you talk about different, very pertinent, but, you know, quite hilarious aspects of feminism.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, in a way, it's a stand-up comedy style to it.
Yeah.
So had you done much stand-up or any stand-up before doing that?
No. Oh. None. Zero. So the way me and Deborah met, we were at a party. It was Phoebe Waller-Bridge was having a party.
Oh my God, I'd kill to be at that party.
This is what I did. I turned up, this is a couple of years ago, I turned up so sad, heartbreak, Actually, no, he's actually really nice. But we're friends now.
But for the sake of the drama.
But
the
stupid,
story,
yeah. Stupid boy. And I turned up really sad. And everyone's having a really great time. And honestly, I was that guy at a party. I was moping. I was like, oh God, why am I here? And it was on the 30th of December. My birthday's on New Year's Eve. So it turned midnight. And I was like, quietly,
Happy birthday.
I was miserable. And then Vicky Jones, who runs Dry Right with Phoebe, came over, saw that I was miserable, and was like, right, I'm going to introduce you to this woman. Introduced me to Deborah. And she was like, this is Susan. Susan's normally funny.
What an opener.
And I was
brilliant.
Like, hi. Yeah, and Deborah immediately was like, awesome, brilliant. I'm going to follow you on Facebook and then we'll be friends. And I was like, cool. And so the next day she really did. And then about a week later, she was like, we're doing a series of shows. Would you like to be a guest? I was like, sure, I can be a guest. I'm less sad now. This is good. So I was a guest. Really enjoyed it. And then she was like, floated. Would you perhaps would like to co-host? I don't know. Go. And I was like, yeah, kind of. Did notice that you do 5 minutes of stand-up when you co-host. And I've never done. She was like, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. Just do it. Just do it for 5 minutes. What's 5 minutes? Anyway, so eventually I went, sure. And then she booked me for like 3 different episodes in 1 week. So I had to come up with 15 minutes of stand-up. So I was like, absolutely freaking out before my first show. And you can hear it, actually, because I go up to the mic and I'm like, apparently meant to do stand-up, but I'm not going to do stand-up. I'm just going to tell you a funny story. And then I do it, and I turned to Deborah and was like, how was that? And she goes, that was stand-up. How irritating that you just go ahead and do it. So I've never done stand-up outside of The Guilty Feminist. I don't think I ever would, because it's such a safe space. I mean, you know,
you've got to be funny. I mean, that crowd will tell you if you're not funny. But, like, it's such a safe space and you can talk about anything. And kind of like the Fleabag analogy of, you know, saying something poignant and also making people laugh, that's a space to really do that. So, yeah, that was my first foray and only foray into stand-up.
So, I mean, we're very brave still. What's your process for writing in terms of perhaps that which you did for The Guilty Feminist, but then also some of the screenplays that you've done and, you know, in your short film as well, Love the Sinner. Yeah, which I watched.
Did you?
Yeah,
no, I'm so proud
of that.
Yeah.
So my process is kind of, because I act, it's, I learned in my head, I was like, right, what happens when I write is I go to a country estate and I'm eating crumpets and I'm there with my Mac and I'm just creating the next big thing, basically. But I don't have the time. So what I've learned is that when I have a window to write, I write. The time that I like to write is sort of midnight till about 6-7 in the morning.
So in bed?
Yeah. Because that's, I'm less likely to have distractions. There's something about nighttime. I'm so nocturnal.
I mean, this is why you don't sleep. You just carved out the exact sleeping hours and being I write.
That's when my friends are like, oh, that's when you're awake. That's when you're probably, okay, cool, I'll text you then. So that's when I like to, ideally like to write. But for instance, doing the play at the moment, if I did that, that's just not healthy.
Yeah.
So it is just about finding the opportunity. I'm not strict about it. If I just feel like, oh, I've got an hour, I can do something, I'll do it. For instance, you know, you mentioned that I co-wrote an episode of The Reluctant Landlord. I was doing that on my phone on the set of Rabbit.
You're kidding.
Yeah, that's how. So I had to download Final Draft app and I'd get notes from Sky and then I just have to do them on my phone.
How frustrating with that tiny keyboard.
Yeah, my thumb hurt. And it was very dexterous.
Oh my God, so I was going to say, do you get shaky thumb? But if you're cold as well, then you get seriously shaky thumb.
I mean, there was typos that you wouldn't imagine. Like Sean Pye would be like, what was that word? I was like, you figure it out, Sean. He was great to work with. But that was the only time I could do it. Because otherwise, we're doing loads of split days, which means that you start a bit later, but you finish filming later. So it's like, in my head, I could go, oh, when we wrap, I'll start, right? I'll fall asleep. So I knew I had to do it on set.
Do you like being that busy? Or is it slightly that sense of, I can't say no to the work because you never know when the next piece of work's going to come along?
Mm. Yeah, I definitely still have that mentality. I think that anyone who doesn't is
a fool.
Nicole Kidman?
Oh, apparently Judi Dench still has. I'm sure I've read an interview where she says, well, you know, you don't want to turn down work.
And really?
It's like, I think you could, Judi.
I think, Judi, you're fine, mate. You did an 8-minute appearance that got you an Oscar. I think you're fine, but... But no, I joke. Of course, there is. And also, I still have that element in my head where, yes, things are going really well and things are opening up to me, particularly with the writing. That was not on the cards. And when these opportunities come along, I don't take every opportunity. I do exercise my right to say no a lot. You know, if I'm going to be an actress and be a writer, I have to do it at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, I just have to do it at the same time. Or, because, you know what? We said we laughed that I'm flush. I'm not flush at all. So if I'm going to take, like, for instance, I did the writer's room for the second series of Sex Education.
Yeah.
And that was a conscious take a month out of acting.
Right, okay. And so starting to actually put the writing before the acting in that sense.
And just go, and that was the first time I ever said, let's hold everything else and let me do that. And so slowly I'm learning to do that, especially with my film, that you know, that's my project. But I do both. And sometimes it's great and I love doing both. Sometimes it's a pain in the arse.
Yeah.
In terms of your writing then, and the way you approach it, do you have a set of golden rules that you try and implement?
So everything that I write is personal. You know, I have flirted with writing things that are less personal. I did write on Reluctant Landlord, which wasn't my show. But in terms of the things that I enjoy writing, because it's a joy. Acting is a thing that is an absolute joy, but can really, really irritate and depress when you don't get that job or when the job falls through, or, you know, you take the job and then you're like, this isn't the job that I thought it was going to be. So that's work. Like, for me, acting is, it's a joy, but it is work. And writing was all, I was never going to do writing if it was going to depress me in the way that acting can. So I'm very cautious about what I sign up for. And it has to be something that touches me emotionally. It just has to. But other people can, you know, write for hire, and that's amazing. But I just know that it has to say something to me personally. So it's first and foremost, it has to be personal.
What about in the way you actually execute the writing when you come to your process? Is there something that you think I have to have? For example, it has to be, there have to be, the majority of the characters have to be female,
oh,
for example.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm not interested in writing male leads. Sorry.
You're no, not actually, alone.
I mean, that's a bit of a lie. My film does have men in it. Blah. The setup for my film 3 Weeks is about this woman who splits up with her recent situationship and realises she's pregnant and then chooses to have a termination whilst also starting a new relationship with this much younger guy. And so, yes, it's the setup is a love triangle, as it were, but it's not at all. It's not about that. Of course it isn't. We're talking about termination. It's about other things. So, yes, I do have men in my thing. But, no, the protagonists are women, and there will be non-white women in the leads as well. They don't have to look like me necessarily at all, but making it as diverse as possible to prove you can tell a story, you can touch people without thinking, you know, what are we used to seeing on screen? Like, I'm just not interested in that. I had a really funny conversation with Daisy, who was in my short film, Daisy May Cooper, when she was first developing This Country. And now the production company at the time didn't want her to play her because she wasn't attractive enough.
No.
You just think, what? But the thing is, I can so imagine that happening. Going, love the script. Suze, we love the story. Can we have someone else playing the lead role? I can totally see that happening.
I mean, but that show would just not be that show without them in it. That's what's just...
Yeah,
you're right, you can imagine that conversation happening.
Totally. And so one of the things that I'm absolutely... is actually, I was speaking to... I just feel like I'm name-dropping. I'm absolutely not.
Oh, you do. I love a name-drop.
So I was speaking ages ago to Charlie Cavell, who wrote End of the Fucking World. Just a fantastic human being, and we were talking about her experience writing with Russell T Davis on I think she wrote on Cucumber Banana, I keep getting confused. I think she wrote an episode of Banana and she was in it, and they were talking about whether you write the description, the physical descriptions of characters, because I hate it when it's like, oh, curvy, or oh, thin, or like, to, you might as well just say Sarah, played by Kate Winslet.
Just list the actor you have
just
in mind.
Tell us who you want. So she was saying that Russell T, please forgive me if this is Russell T Davis, please forgive me if this is wrong, but she said that he puts down the ethnicity of each character because, and she's, you know, she asked why, you know, why is that important? And he said, well, if you don't, you will get, you know, a list of actors to see for that role who are white.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I heard that on the US podcast Script Notes, and they said the exact same thing. But then it should also go by the same rule, should it, that you'd be saying you'd also be listing white? I mean, I just don't know when somebody's white, because otherwise is it weird just to do it for characters of another
ethnicity? I'd say,
I mean,
everyone.
Just, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely everyone, because it will bear nothing on the script or the story at all. But if you don't do that, you really will get a list of actors that are white for whatever reason.
And potentially male as well. And they just said it just helps the casting director out. It's like, if it is, let's say, doctor, just write female and black. And then it's like, great, okay, well then we're seeing these actors for it.
Yeah, and you have to be that. We want to live in a utopia where you don't have to do that. But I just feel like
we have to go a bit further before we can potentially go back to not having to do that. Yeah. I think that's sort of the climate we're in at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of in terms of the characters I write. There are some certain characters where that is important. And not just in regards to race, it'll be in terms of gender or physical ability or anything like that. Like, I feel like you have to write it. But I will literally look at the end of the script and be like, cool, that person is this, that person's that. And my rule is also make more than one. Like, don't just...
Yes.
Like, you can employ 2 disabled actors and then that's the end of it. Like, rather than one actor having to, you know, be the beacon of every person with cerebral palsy. Like, do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
I feel like one of the things... I was talking to another actor actually in the show who... Because he was talking about how he meets a lot of his friends. He meets a lot of his friends on jobs all the time. And I was like, God, I don't meet a lot of my black girlfriends on jobs because it's either one of us.
That's such an interesting point.
Wow. Never.
Whereas everyone else is coming across,
Very, very rarely will I actually work with other black women on jobs ever because it's only one of us. And if there's more than one of us, it's because we're related. I'm like, we can not be related.
Yes.
So, yeah, so I've sort of gone on a tangent there. But yeah, that's one of the things that I absolutely prioritise, is making sure that it's... Obviously, it depends where it's, when it's set, you know, what you're saying with, you know, race and identity and gender and all of that. But for me, it's, you've got to prove how easy it is.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's what I do in my tiny corner of writing.
So if you could wave a magic wand over this industry, including the acting and writing aspects of it, what is it you would ideally change?
I would make things more diverse right at the top. So I'm talking about people who greenlight projects and talking about people who run channels and networks, and that's where it has to, that's where it has to change. It has to be there. Because actually, there's loads of acting talent. There's loads of writing talent. That is not the issue. So when people get sort of a bit, you know, funny about quotas, it's like, no, the talent is there. That's not the problem. And I don't think that it's this large conspiracy of racism. Like, if we're just talking about race, I know that diversity encompasses so much more than that. But if we just look at racism, I think it is this, like, let's all be racist. I think that it's just about what are we used to seeing on television? Yeah. Who are our star actors? Who are the people who draw viewerships? Their names, and a lot of the names are white. Like, I will flock to see Olivia Colman paint a wall. I will watch that on repeat again and again and again, no question. It's just understanding that we have our stars, and it's about actually taking a risk, I say in inverted commas, and probably giving an opportunity to an actor who isn't necessarily a household name, and not quaking and, you know, being sure that the story will carry it and hopefully make them a household name and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
I think you're doing a great job in pioneering that sort of thing yourself. Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Oh, yeah.
So do you see your career then, in terms of, if you look forward to the next 10 years, do you see it staying this sort of the same way it is at the moment with the ratio of acting to writing you're doing, or can you see yourself heading further in one direction than the other?
Ideally, I would love to have the time and resources to just focus on writing, just for like a year or a couple of years, and get things made, basically. I think that is going to be happening for the first time next year, when hopefully my film goes into production.
Are you in that as well?
Yeah, I'll be in it as well. Yeah. She's writing herself all the parts.
I would come on,
diversity,
gutter.
Diversity. And I'm like, me, talk about me, talk about me. Oh, yeah, no, I just want to make it a better place for everybody. I'm like, me, write myself all the parts, me. But ideally, in the next 10 years, I would love to just write something and hand it over to people and go, right, go make it. Or directing as well, I'd love to get into, definitely. And yeah, sort of taking a break from acting, as it were, for a few years to concentrate on making stuff, and then having a welcome return.
A warm hugging embrace. Yeah, yeah.
So finally then, Susan, if there is one thing or something that your career in comedy and drama has taught you about life, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, that's a really good question. The world is kind of scary, but now we know how scary it is. Well, we're very attuned to how bloody scary it is. And I feel like, you know, on a global scale, on a personal scale as well, it's really easy to feel completely battered by life, the world, whatever. And one of the things that I've realised about my job is that there is no point going through the auditions, going through all the drafts, going through the notes from the channels and all of that stuff, not sleeping and all of that, if you're not finding joy in what you're doing. And like, there's absolutely no point freezing my bollocks off in Luton in a corset if I don't love it. Like, it seems mad to do that. And so I've really, particularly in the last few months actually, I've really come full circle in understanding that you have to find the joy in what you do. And that is when I create my best work, and when I work with people that I absolutely adore is when I'm going, where is the joy in it? So I would say that has definitely impacted my life, where I'm now looking at the people in my life, the people that I love, that I give my time to, like, who brings joy, who do I give joy. There's this actor who won a Tony this year for a musical, who said, he, you know, quite a bit old, I've forgotten his name, please forgive me. He said he was going over his, like, rules for life or something, and he's like, surround yourself with people who are, when you walk into a room, they're happy to see you.
Yeah.
And when he said that, it really hit a nerve. I'm only interested in people who are happy to see me.
Well, we're delighted to see you and to have you.
Thank you so much
thank
for
you
coming
ever
on the
so
podcast.
Much. You've been absolutely brilliant. Thank
Cheers,
you.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
greatbigowl.com.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.